Chapter 18. I gritted my teeth and got out of Butters's car, then paused to look at my surroundings. The piled snow was deep, and the mounds on either side of the street were like giant-sized versions of the snow ramparts that appeared every year in the carpenter's backyard. They changed the outlines of everything, but something was familiar. I stopped and took at least half a minute to turn in a slow circle. As I did, I noticed a pair of fleeting shadows moving easily over the snow. Wolves. Murphy's comment about sending shadows to escort Butters home made more sense in context. I watched one of the wolves vanish into the darkness between a pair of half-familiar pines, and only then did I recognize where we stood. By then, Butters had taken Bob from his holder in the car and was carrying him in the handheld spotlight case again. He shone the light around for a moment until he spotted me, then asked, "Harry? This is my house," I said after a moment. "I mean, where my house was." Things had changed. A new building had been put up where my old boarding house, my home, had been. The new place was 4 stories tall and oddly cubical in appearance. The walls fell even farther out onto the lawn than those in the old building had, encasing it in a strip of yard only slightly wider than my stride. I moved close enough to touch the wall and pushed my hand inside. It hurt, but the hurt never varied as I pushed in farther. There was no facade. It was made of stone. I'm not kidding. Freaking stone. Basalt, maybe? I'm no stonemason. It was dark gray with veins and threads of gray and silver running through it, but I could only see them from up close. The windows were narrow, maybe 9 inches wide, and deep. There were bars on the outside. I could see more bars on the inside, and there was at least a foot between them. The roof was lined with a staggered row of blocks. Real, by God, crenellation. As the piece de resistance, gargoyles crouched at the corners and at the midpoint of each wall, starting up at the second floor and moving in 3 rows of increasingly ugly statuary toward the roof. Someone had turned the ruin of my home into a freaking fortress. A plaque hung over what had to be the main entrance. It read simply, "Brighter Future Society." Butters followed my gaze to the plaque. "Ah," he said. "Yeah, we named it that because if we didn't do something, there wasn't going to be much of a future for this town. I wanted Brighter Future Group, actually, for the initialism, but I got voted down." "Hell's bells," I said. I did some math. To build on the ruins of the boarding house, construction would have had to start practically the same day that I died. Actual stone is expensive to build with because it's difficult and time-consuming. This place was as big as a small castle. It should have taken months and months and months to build. It had gone up in 6, probably significantly less given the weather. This place cost a damn fortune. "Meh," Butters said, and walked to the front door. "Hang around a bit, and you'll take it for granted like the rest of us." He entered a sequence of numbers on the keypad beside the door. They made a little mechanical clicking sound that reminded me of a manual typewriter. He put his hands back into his pockets and waited. A moment later, a heavily accented basso voice emerged from a crackling speaker box.
"Who goes there?"
"Butters," he said, "with Dresden Shade. Hi, Sven." The speaker made a rumbling sound.
"Waldo," it said. "The night is dangerous. One day you'll stumble across a fox and it will eat you."
Roars of laughter erupted from the speakers. Evidently, several other men were with the door guard. Butters didn't laugh, but he did grin.
"I'll just get stuck in his throat until you can haul your walrus ass over to him and save me, Sven."
Louder laughter erupted from the speaker, and a voice half-choked with it said something in a language that had come from somewhere in Northern Europe. There was a click, and Butters opened the door. I started to follow him in and remembered in time to put my hand out and check the doorway first. My hand moved smoothly past the 12 inches of stone, but then hit something as solid as a brick wall where the doorway opened up into the entry hall.
Butters, I said.
He smacked the heel of his hand against his forehead.
Right, sorry.
Please, come in. The invisible wall vanished, and I shook my head.
It's got a threshold. People live here?
Bunch of them, Butters confirmed, and we went inside. Lot of Perronetters come through for a little while when they don't have a safe place to sleep. Visiting netters who are passing through town. Venatori, when they meet with us, that kind of thing.
I felt anger stirring in me, irrational but no less real. My home is a supernatural flophouse?
And armory and jail, Bob said enthusiastically.
Ghosts can sputter in outrage.
Jail? And daycare, Bob continued.
I stopped in my tracks and threw my hands up. Daycare.
Daycare?
People have kids, man, and they have jobs, Butter said in a gentle voice. The Fomor aren't above using children to get what they want. High-risk kids come here on work days. Now shut up, Bob, and get off your high horse, Harry. People need this place. I turned my gaze to Butters and studied him for a minute. The little guy had come a long way from the somewhat timid, insecure man I'd first met years before. That Butters would never have said anything like that to me. Or maybe he was the same guy. Butters went right to the wall for the sake of the truth, even when it cost him his job and got him locked up in a nut house. He was a man of principles, and he was probably right. This wasn't my home anymore. We passed the guard station after we got buzzed through a security gate. Four of the biggest, toughest-looking men I'd ever seen were stationed there. They wore biker leathers and swords. Their muscles swelled tight against their skin, their beards bristled, and their uniformly pale eyes watched us pass with calm attention.
Einherr Jarn, Butters said quietly. Soldiers of Valhalla, if they're telling the truth.
They are, I replied just as quietly. Where did we get them?
Marcone. They aren't cheap.
Him again. Butters shrugged. I don't like the guy either, Harry, but he's smart enough to realize that if the Fomor take control of the streets, they're going to get rid of him as a matter of course.
Too simple, I said. Too easy. He's running some kind of game on you.
We went through another door and then up some stairs, which opened onto the second floor. The place was one enormous chamber, almost entirely free of interior walls. There was a small gym, complete with shower rooms, and a boxing ring. Inside the ring, Murphy, wearing her street clothes, stood facing a man who had inherited a portion of his DNA from a rhinoceros, and not many generations ago. He was huge and heavily muscled, his dark hair and beard in long braids. He wore an old pair of jeans and nothing else. His upper body was coated with more dark hair, not like a werewolf or circus freak or anything, just at the top end of the hirsute bell curve. A real hairball. Butters froze in place, waiting. Murphy stared steadily at the big man for several moments, her body relaxed, her eyes never blinking. He returned a blank stare of his own. Then they both moved. I couldn't tell who went first, but Murphy's fist streaked toward the big guy's groin. He twisted his hip, deflecting the blow, and when he returned it to balance, his leg scythed up in an arc that clipped the tip of Murphy's chin. She spun away and went down. Hairball did not hesitate for so much as a second. He moved toward her, fast, for someone so large, and stomped his heel down toward her head. Murphy rolled and dodged the blow, but he followed up, and she had to keep rolling to stay ahead of his sledgehammer heels. She hit the edge of the boxing ring, then abruptly reversed her roll, moving toward him instead of away. She slipped the next stomp, scissored his knee with her legs, twisted her whole body, and brought him down. Hairball fell like a tree, huge and slow. The boxing ring ropes shook when he landed. Murphy came up onto all fours, scrambled a bit to one side, and then swept her foot at Hairball's head. He dodged, but her kick shifted direction, her leg moving up, then straight down, bringing her heel down like a hatchet onto the hand Hairball was using to support his weight. Bones snapped. Hairball howled, scrambled to his feet, and started swinging wildly at her. Murphy dodged and slipped one blow after another, and at one point abruptly turned and drove her heel into Hairball's solar plexus. The blow rocked him back a step, but Murphy followed it too closely, too recklessly. Hairball recovered from the kick almost instantly, slapped a blow aside, and seized her arm. He turned and flung her, one-handed, over the top rope of the ring and into the nearest wall. She hit it with a yell and bounced off onto the floor.
Dead, I snarled, my fists clenched.
I started forward and took three or four whole steps before I realized that I wasn't going to be able to hit the guy, or blow him up, or send him on a vacation to another reality. Hell, I couldn't even sneak up on him and shout boo.
Harry, wait, Butters hissed. It's okay.
Murphy picked herself up from the floor, moving slowly. As she did, the giant Hairball came over to the nearest side of the ring, holding his right hand in his left. Murphy brushed some dust from her clothing and turned to face him. Her blue eyes were steady and cold, her mouth set in a small smile. Her teeth were white, and rich red blood quivered on her lower lip where the impact had split it open. She wiped the blood off on her sleeve without looking away from Hairball.
Three? She asked. Broke off four, he said, moving his right hand a little by way of demonstration. Took out my best sword hand. Good. If you hadn't gotten greedy for the kill, maybe you'd have taken this round.
Murphy snorted.
You've been drinking bad mead, Skaldi Skildsen.
That made Hairball smile.
Sword tomorrow?
Murphy nodded. The two of them stared at each other for a moment, as if each expected the other to suddenly charge the second the other turned his back. Then, with no detectable signal passing between them, they simultaneously nodded again and turned away from each other, relaxing.
Butters?
Rumbled Scaldy Hairball. If he really had broken fingers, it didn't look like they were bothering him much.
When are you going to get in this ring and train like a man?
About 5 minutes after I get a functional lightsaber?
Butters replied easily, much to Hairball's amusement. Then the little medical examiner nodded to Murphy and said, Can we talk in the conference room?
Sure, she said.
She walked by the ring and bumped left fists with Scaldy. Then she led Butters and me out of the gym, down another hallway, and into a long, narrow conference room. She shut the door behind us, and Butters popped Bob's flashlight onto the table. His eye lights winked on again, and I saw Murphy react visibly when that light revealed my presence. She stiffened a little, looking at me, and her eyes showed a sudden weariness and pain. She took a deep breath through her nose and closed her eyes for a second. Then she took off her jacket, moving gingerly, and said,
Hi, Harry.
Butters put the radio on the table, and I said, Hi, Murph. She was wearing thin, light padding under the jacket like the stuff I'd seen on stuntmen on a case I'd done not long after I'd gone into business. So her full contact practice hadn't been as vicious as it had looked. She'd be covered in bruises, but the impact with the wall hadn't actually been likely to break her back. Her skull, maybe, but not her back.
You okay?
She rolled one shoulder with a grimace of discomfort. I will be.
Big guy like that going to town on you, I growled. Someone needs to push his face in.
Her eyes glittered as she gave me a sharp look.
Dresden,
when exactly am I going to fight someone my size and strength?
If you want to wrestle hostile mooses,
moose, Butters corrected absently, singular and plural, same word.
Gorillas, Murphy continued, hardly breaking stride.
Then the best way to train for it is by wrestling slightly less hostile gorillas. Scaldy's 200 pounds heavier than me, almost 2 feet taller, and he has going on 2 millennium. Millennia, Butters said. Millennium is the singular. Murphy pushed a breath out through her nose and said, "Millennia of experience in breaking the backs of annoying little doctors with annoying little grammar fetishes." Butters grinned. "I'm not going to beat him, Harry. Ever. That isn't the point." She looked away and her voice became quiet. "The point is that the world isn't getting any kinder. A girl's got to take care of herself." The expression on her face? It hurt. Hearing the words that went with it felt like a knife peeling back layers of skin. I didn't say anything. I didn't let it show. Murphy would have been offended at the notion that she needed my protection. And if she thought I felt guilty for not being there to protect her, to help her, she'd be downright angry. Don't get me wrong, I didn't think Murphy was a princess in a tower. But at the end of the day, she was just one person, standing in defiance of powers that would regard her with the same indifference as might an oncoming tsunami, volcanic eruption, or earthquake. Life is precious, fragile, fleeting, and Murphy's life was one of my favorites. "Okay, Harry," Murphy said, "where do we get started?" I felt awkward standing there while she and Butters sat at the table, but it wasn't like I could pull out a chair. Maybe we get started with what you know about my shooting. She nodded and pulled on her cop face, her expression professionally calm, detached, analytical. "We don't have much, officially speaking," she said. "I came to pick you up and found the blood and a single bullet hole. There wasn't quite enough to declare it a murder scene because you were on the boat and it was in motion. There was no way to extrapolate precisely where the bullet came from. Probably a nearby rooftop. Because the bullet apparently began to tumble as it passed through your body, it left asymmetric holes in the walls of the boat. But forensics thinks it was something between a .223 assault rifle round and a .338 Magnum rifle round. More likely the latter than the former." "I never got into rifles. What does that mean?" "It means a sniper rifle or a deer rifle," Butters clarified. "Not necessarily military. There are plenty of civilian weapons that fire rounds in those calibers." "We never found the bullet," Murphy said. She took a deep breath. "Or the body." I noticed that both Murph and Butters were staring at me very intently. I said, "I sort of did that whole tunnel of light thing, which is a crock, by the way. I bit down on a mention of Murphy's father. I was sent back to solve the murder, which sort of implies a death. And they said my body wasn't available, so..." Murphy looked down and nodded. "Huh," Butters said, frowning. "Why send you back?" I shrugged, said what came next wasn't for whiners or rubberneckers. Murphy snorted. "Sounds like something my father would say." "Yeah," I said. "Huh." Butters arched an eyebrow. His dark eyes flickered between me and Murphy, and thoughtful lines appeared on his face. "Anyway," I said, "that's what you know officially, right? So, what else do you know?" "I know it wasn't Marcone," Murphy said. "All of his troubleshooters have alibis that check out. So do he and Guard and Hendricks. I know which building the shot probably came from, and it wasn't an easy one." 450 yards, Butters said, "which means it was probably a professional gunman." "There are amateurs who can shoot that well," Murphy said. "As a rule, they don't do it from buildings at their fellow Americans," Butters replied. "Look, if we assume it's an amateur, it could be anyone. But if we assume it was a professional, which is way more likely in any case, then it gives us the beginning of an identity and could lead us back to whomever he works for." "Even if we do assume that," Murphy said, "I don't have the access to information that I used to. We'd need to review TSA video records, security cameras, all kinds of things I can't get to anymore."
"Your brother-in-law can," I said. "Dick can."
"Richard," she corrected me. "He hates that nickname."
"Dick who?"
Butters asked, looking between us.
I said, "her brother-in-law," at the same time she said, "my ex-husband."
Butters' brow arched even farther, and he shook his head.
"Man, Catholics."
Murphy gave him a gimlet look. Richard runs by the book. He won't help a civilian.
Oh, come on, Murph, I said. You were married to the guy. You've got to have some dirt on him.
She shook her head. It isn't a crime to be an asshole, Harry. If it was, I'd have put him away for life.
Butters cleared his throat. We could ask...
No, Murphy and I said at the same time and continued speaking over each other. The day I ask for that bastard's help will be the day I told you before, over and over, that just because he's reasonable doesn't mean he's a murderer and a drug dealer and a pimp, and just because Chicago's corrupt government can't put him away doesn't mean you were smarter than that, Murphy finished.
Butters lifted his hands mildly.
Okay, okay. I was on board at no... No going to Marcone for help. He paused and looked around the room as if he'd never seen it before. Because that would be unprecedented.
Wally, Murphy said, one eyebrow arching dangerously.
He held up his hands again. Uncle, I don't understand your reasoning, but okay.
You think Marcone was behind it, Harry? Murphy asked. I shrugged. Last time I saw him, he said he didn't need to kill me, that I'd get myself killed without any help from him.
Murphy frowned. It made her lip hurt, and she winced, reaching up. The wince made it hurt worse, apparently, because fresh blood appeared.
Damn it. Well, you can take that a couple of different ways, can't you?
Like how?
Murphy looked at me. Like maybe Marcone knew something was happening already, and that's why he said he didn't need to kill you? It wasn't him, but it was still something he was aware of.
I grunted. Marcone ran Chicago like his own personal clubhouse. He had legions of employees, allies, and flunkies. His awareness of what happened in his city wasn't supernatural. It was better than that. He was rational, intelligent, and more prepared for a crisis than any man I'd ever seen. If the Eagle Scouts had some sort of Sith equivalent, Marcone was it. If someone's wet work specialist had come to town, Marcone was very likely to have learned of it. He and his underworld network missed little.
Damn it, Murphy said, evidently coming to the same conclusions I had. Now I have to talk to the scum.
She got out her little notepad and scribbled on it. Butters, you said that Lindquist's house had burned down?
Big time, said Butters.
I nodded. According to the ghosts hanging around it, the gray ghost showed up.
I didn't tell you about the gray ghost, did I?
Mr. Lindquist filled us in after the shooting, Butters said.
Oh, right. Anyway, it showed up with several mortals and snatched him. We've got to get him back.
Murphy nodded, still writing.
What happens if we don't?
A bunch of serial killer type ghosts start wandering around Chicago looking for a good time.
Ghosts like that can manifest, make themselves the next best thing to real, Murph.
Like the nightmare, people will get hurt, a lot of them.
Murphy's mouth thinned into a line. She wrote on her notepad.
We'll do triage in a minute. What else?
I found the gang who shot up your house last night, I said.
The tip of Murphy's pencil snapped against the notepad. She looked up at me and her eyes were cold, furious. She spoke in a very quiet voice.
Oh?
Yeah, I said.
I paused for a moment to think about what I was going to say.
Murphy's temper was not a force to be invoked lightly.
I don't think you're going to have to worry about them anymore.
Why? She asked in her cop voice. Did you kill them?
There had been a little too much intensity in that question.
Wow.
Murphy was clearly only too ready to go after these guys the minute she knew where they were.
I glanced at Butters, who looked like someone sitting near an armed explosive.
No, I said, working out my words carefully. If Murphy's fuse was really as short as it seemed, I didn't want her charging off to deal with Fitz and his poor crew and true Viking tradition.
But they don't have the resources they had before. I don't think they're going to hurt anybody in the immediate future.
That's your professional opinion, is it?
Yes.
She stared at me for a minute, then said, Abby was standing on my patio last night when they came by.
She took a round in the belly during that attack. She didn't get down fast enough. They don't know if she's going to live or not. I thought of the plump, cheerful little woman and swallowed. I didn't know, Murph. I'm sorry. She continued speaking as if I hadn't said anything. There was a retiree living in the house behind mine. He used to give me tomatoes he grew in his garden every summer. He wasn't as lucky as Abby. The bullet hit him in the neck while he was sleeping in bed. He had enough time to wake up, terrified, and knock the handset of his phone out of its cradle before he bled out. Hell's bells. That put a different spin on things. I mean, I'd been hoping to go for a no-harm, no-foul argument with Murphy. But if blood had been spilled and lives lost... Well, I knew Murphy. Whether or not she was a cop anymore, she wasn't going to back away. "Where are they?" she asked. "This is not a time to kick down doors," I told her. "Please, hear me out." Her hand tightened into a fist, but she visibly took control of her anger, took a deep breath, and then nodded. "Go ahead." I told her about Fitz and his gang. I told her about Aristides. "I notice, Harry," she said, "that you didn't tell me where they are." "Yeah," I said, I sort of told the kid I would help him, that you would help him." Murphy narrowed her eyes. "You did what?" "They're kids, Murph," I said. "In over their heads, they need help." "They've killed at least one person, maybe more," Murphy said. "There are still laws in this town, Dresden. Send the cops in and it'll get ugly. I'm not sure how much juice their boss has, but even if he can't shoot, he'd be a nightmare for the police, even SI. Murphy frowned. "How sure are you about that?" "Guys like him use fear and violence as daily tools. He won't think twice about hurting a cop." Murphy nodded. "Then I'll deal with him." "Murph, I know you can handle yourself, but..." "Dresden, I have dealt with two men since the shooting, who were skilled enough for Carlos to call them the next best thing to full council quality warlocks. I've handled several lesser talents, too. The Fomor like to use them as officers and commanders. I know what I'm doing." "You've killed them," I said quietly. "That's what you mean, isn't it?" She looked away. It was a moment before she answered. "With someone that powerful, there's not really a choice. If you try to take them alive, they have plenty of time to kill you." I winced in sympathy for her. She might not be a cop anymore, but it was where her heart lay, with the law. She believed in it, truly believed that the law was meant to serve and protect the people of Chicago. When she was a cop, it had always been her job to make sure that those laws worked toward that purpose in whatever way she could manage. She loved serving her city under the rule of law, and that meant judges and juries got to do their job before the executioners stepped in. If Murphy had dispensed with that belief, regardless of how practical and necessary it had been, regardless if doing so had saved lives, Butters had said that she was under stress. I now knew the nature of that stress. Guilt. It would be ripping away steadily at her insides, at her conscience, scraping them both raw. "They were all killers," she said, though I don't think she was talking to me. "Killers and kidnappers, and the law couldn't touch them. Someone had to do something." "Yeah," I said, "someone always does." "The point is," she continued, "that the way you deal with this kind of problem is to hit it with absolutely everything you've got, and to do it immediately, before those spellcasting yahoos have enough time to fort up, bend people's minds into defending them, or to start coming after you, or someone you care about." She looked up at me. "I need the address." "You don't," I said. "I'll bring the kids to you. Once you get them away from Aristides, he's out of help and vulnerable. Then you can help Fitz and company." "Fitz and company," she said in a flat tone, "are murderers." "But no, Harry. Don't give me any rap about how they didn't mean it. They opened fire with deadly weapons in a residential neighborhood. In the eyes of the law and anyone the least bit reasonable, it was an accident is unconvincing. They knew what could happen. Their intentions are irrelevant." "I know," I said. "But these aren't bad kids. They're just scared. It drove them to a bad choice." "You've just described most of the gang members in this town, Harry. They don't join the gang because they're bad kids. They do it because they're frightened. They want to feel like they belong somewhere, safe. She shook her head. It doesn't matter if they started out as good kids. Life changes them, makes them something they weren't.
What do you want to do?
Take a team to their hideout. Deal with the sorcerer. We'll make every effort to avoid harming the others.
You're going to open fire with deadly weapons on their home. Maybe you don't want to hurt the kids, but you know what could happen. If you wind up with bodies on the floor, your intentions would be irrelevant. Is that what you're telling me?
Her eyes flashed with sudden anger. You haven't been here the past 6 months. You don't know what it's been like. You...
She pressed her lips together, then she looked at me and stared, clearly, waiting.
I said very quietly,
no.
She shook her head several times, then she said, the real Dresden wouldn't hesitate.
The real Dresden would never have gotten a chance to see them, to talk to them. He'd just skip to the fight.
She flipped her notepad closed with a snap of her wrist and stood. Then we've covered what needs doing. There's nothing more to discuss.
Murphy got up and left the room without a word, her steps smooth and purposeful.
Butters rose and collected Bob and the little spirit radio.
I usually follow along after her when she's setting up something. Take care of the details. Excuse me.
Sure, I said quietly. Thanks for your help, Butters.
Anytime, he said.
You too, Bob, I said.
De nada,
the skull replied.
Butters hurried out. I was left standing in the conference room, alone.